guest right now is Julie Clark, and I've asked her to come talk to us. She's a math professor at Hollins University because statistics, data, numbers, they're all packed with information, but you need to pay attention because they can also be used to mislead people. I majored in math, statistics, and computer science, and I remember being told once that you can spin statistics to prove almost any hypothesis. So we've asked Julie to come in and talk about this. So Julie, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Great to have you. The practice of cherry picking data and using statistics to sort of just prove a preconceived or idea is nothing new, right?
Oh, absolutely not. It's been done as long as we've had whatever someone considers to be statistics. So, yeah.
Right, because a lot of times, and I've seen it even with studies, that they do a whole study and it's really just to prove a predetermined idea. Like, they wanted to prove that this is true, so they did a study to prove it, which always makes me a little cautious.
Well, it should make you cautious because we can't use statistics to prove what we're assuming. We can only use it to prove the opposite of what we're assuming. So
In
if
reality, yes.
in reality that can't be done.
So in
So
reality, the statistics are only able to disprove a theory, not really confirm a theory.
right. They can find evidence against a hypothesis, or they can find no evidence against it, but they can't find evidence in favor of a hypothesis.
So if
So
somebody says they have a study or they have statistics that prove this to be true,
don't
right?
shake your head and say, no, I don't believe it. It couldn't be possible.
So that's when the big alarm in your head should go off that says, wait a minute, something's wrong here.
Something really wrong here. Whoever's looking at those numbers is not looking at them correctly.
Well, and that's something I was just going to say is, in that case, maybe look to see who's funding that study.
Absolutely. Absolutely look to see who's funding it. Yes.
Right, which is always, especially in the case of a study, I think always good to see who's funding the study, because who's funding it, if it's going to sway the outcome, then it's just interesting information. It's not really true data and statistics to give you the facts.
It's certainly not objective data. So you would have to take it with a grain of salt. That's not to say that, someone who's funding a study can't fund a legitimate study, but you do need to take such data with a grain of salt and look for ways that a bias might have come in and be influencing the interpretation of those numbers.
So what are some of, you say look for a possible bias. What would, like, an average person, if they're reading a story or looking at results of a study, are there kind of specific things they could look for that would be telltale markers that maybe this isn't the most accurate objective study?
Can't think of one off the top of my head because, of course, it's going to vary from situation to situation. But I can think, for example, of a drug study that finds that a new drug is 50% more effective than an existing drug. Well, you need to know what the existing drug's effect rate is. If it's only effective in 1% of the cases and the new drug is 50% more effective, that means it's effective in two cases, which is,
Not
that's
really a
great,
big
but not
difference.
necessarily a big difference. So you have to have the whole picture, not just, the headline.
Right. Well, I think that's probably always true. And this is a common practice in many areas. I mean, right now we see it a lot in politics and of course in health-related things, especially with coronavirus, the pandemic. We see numbers and statistics all the time. The one that I've mentioned several times to people is when they talk about the number of confirmed cases. And I'm like, that tells me nothing unless you give me the rate of testing that goes with it. Because if we have 1,000 people and we only test 10 people, then we could only have 10 positive cases. If we test all 1,000 and you tell me all 1,000 are positive, okay, that's different.
Well, there is some value in knowing the number, even if you don't know the rate of testing, in that if that number is increasing, That's a warning that the virus is there and it's spreading, and you, depending on your health situation, need to be careful. And it's particularly important if those numbers are increasing in your region.
Sure.
It might not matter to you if those numbers are increasing across the country or in another country. But you're absolutely correct that more important than the sheer number of cases is the rate of testing and the rate of positivity.
Which I think is what they keep referring to as the positivity rate, meaning, yes, right. You know, for every 1,000 people, how many tested positive? You know, we tested 1,000, how many positives were there? I mean, that number is much more useful than how many people total tested positive. And I know I've said from a news standpoint that, you know, for me, the number of people hospitalized or the number of deaths is a better gauge in my mind of where there's a spike or whether it's dropping, you know, like especially in our area, in the greater New York area, where it was so bad, you know, when we saw hospitalizations and deaths start to decline, we're like, oh, we're over the hump, we hope. And now on the way to finding, you know, a better balance, and obviously we still need to find a solution. But you know, those numbers to me, because no matter how many people you test or don't test or whatever, you know, the number of people who need to be hospitalized doesn't matter what their tests, you know, that doesn't matter about testing rates or number of positive cases, that those are the ones who are really sick, and the number of people dying, obviously, tragic, is another indicator that you're in a hot spot or not.
Right. Right. And of course that was the initial fear, that our hospitalization rate would get so high so fast that we wouldn't have the facilities to deal with it.
Right.
And we can't avoid the virus. I mean, it's out there, and chances are good that a large proportion of us are going to catch it. What we can't afford is for so many of us to have it at the same time that we overwhelm the hospitals
and the medical system in general, right? Yeah. Which is why it was so bad at the beginning, because you know, you don't know how bad it's going to be, and so everybody was trying to ramp up, but they're behind, you know, they're playing catch up, whereas now most places are probably ready to handle as many people as they could have handled. Like they're ready for maximum capacity if they need to be, whereas before they were just trying to ramp up faster than the virus was spreading.
And the virus was spreading so quickly at that point, and we were unprepared. Now, to be fair, we've ramped up, and almost everywhere is probably able to operate at maximum capacity, but we could still have a problem if the rate of hospitalizations, I guess, got out of control, because if you had more, even at top capacity, than New York could handle, it would be a problem.
Oh, sure, and that's true.
That's a risk.
And that risk is much higher in a smaller community where they don't have as many.
Absolutely.
I mean, in the greater New York area, Fairfield County in Connecticut, Westchester County, New York, you know, New York City, Putnam County, Orange County, all the in New Jersey, you know, all of those areas are very densely populated. We have a lot of hospitals and a lot of medical facilities, a lot of medical professionals. And so in some ways, we're better able to handle if there was a big balloon, you know, number. We don't want to put that to the test again, but if you're in a rural area where there's one hospital,
low density area where there's only one hospital, of course you have fewer people in general that could get infected, but in such an area, three patients might overwhelm a hospital.
Exactly.
So, you know, it could be a huge problem even if the number of hospitalizations is very small.
Exactly, exactly. We're going to take a quick break here for traffic and weather on the sixes at WICC 600. We'll come back and talk more to Julie Clark about statistics and how sometimes they get misused right here. Don't go away. Ann Carrick here today, your guest host on Connecticut Today. Paul's doing the morning show this week. And my guest, Julie Clark, a math professor at Hollins University in Virginia. And I asked her to be here so that we could talk about statistics and how sometimes the numbers and the statistics that you hear are misleading. You know, we were talking a lot about coronavirus. That's one medical issue. But I think the statistics and data in the medical field is a big area where maybe not intentionally misleading, but oftentimes they are misleading. One of the things that we were talking about during the break was how historically everything was tested on men. So all drugs and pharmaceuticals and treatments and how they worked and how effective they were, all done on men. And then they just tried to apply them to women, which you know doesn't really make sense if you think about it, because clearly body chemistry between men and women is different, or we wouldn't be two different types of people. We'd all be one, you know.
There are an awful lot of medical things that are very different in men and women. I happen to know this because I suffer from multiple sclerosis, but the rate of that in women is so much higher than men.
Really?
It's amazing the proportion. It's about 3 to 1.
Oh, wow.
But men seem to be much more badly affected by it.
Oh, so
So they're
if they
much,
get it, it's worse.
if they get it, it's much worse for them than women. In general, those, of course,
Sure.
are examples of things you should not say, because that's not true for all women and for all men. It's a tendency, but
But the statistics show it.
the statistics do show that women are affected much more so than men, and men tend to be have a much more serious case and more problems with it than women.
Interesting. And I think they're finding that's true with a lot of things. Like even we were talking about the coronavirus COVID-19, they haven't quite figured out why and exactly who, but they have certainly determined that, for some reason, some people are really affected by it and others have symptoms that are so mild they don't even realize they have it. They never even get a test because they feel a little run down and, they sleep a little extra a few days and they're good,
Of course, they haven't had very long to study it, but there are reports that men are suffering with the coronavirus worse than women, I think women are being affected at a higher rate than men. I don't know how,
So
that data could change on a
similar to what
daily
you're
basis.
saying with MS,
Similar,
which
yeah.
is maybe
I
more
don't think
women are
the
getting it, but more the men seem to be having a more serious case of it when they do get it.
But of course,
Interesting.
that could change tomorrow because the data is coming in so
Oh,
fast,
yeah.
and we haven't had time to look at it like with other diseases that we've known about for years and years and years. So,
Yeah. And that's something that's worth mentioning because I know, like, when we do news stories, when we have breaking news, for example, and it's like something's happening and you're at the scene of it reporting on it, the information is coming in at such a rapid rate. And, if I'm the reporter, I'm doing my best to turn that information around and get it back to the people who are listening or watching so that they know what's going on. But the reality is, it's changing minute to minute. And when you look back at it later, sometimes it's completely inaccurate, but it was the best information I had at that moment to try to keep people informed. And I think with COVID-19, we're still in that phase. And
oh,
so while the
absolutely.
information is interesting, you have to know that it's not going to be accurate. Like when we look back at this 5 years later, we're going to be like, wow, that was like completely wrong, like what we thought was going on there.
Even a couple of months later, I mean, when we first heard of this in the United States, the CDC was saying, oh, masks are not necessary. They're not helpful. There's no reason for anyone except medical professionals to wear them. Well, then the data came in and it became obvious that that wasn't true anymore. They
Right.
did a rapid turnaround on that, but you can't blame them for going with what they knew at the time.
Well, and at that time, we were reporting that it didn't help prevent, like, if I wear a mask, it wasn't helping to prevent me from getting sick, which is still a little true, but if I'm sick, it prevents me from giving it to somebody else. And I think the other thing was we had such a shortage of masks and PPE in general. We didn't, if without some evidence that it helped, we didn't want people out rushing out to like buy masks when we didn't even know if it was going to do any good. But you're right. And I know
There are
that.
all kinds of numbers like that in regard to COVID that are changing so rapidly that you shouldn't allow yourself to get upset if something you heard 2 months ago has changed now. That
Right.
doesn't mean someone was lying to you then, and it doesn't mean it wasn't correct then. It just means that our understanding of the entire disease has changed
Sure.
as time goes by.
Yeah. And again, like from a reporting standpoint, I happen to have recordings of myself doing the news on 9/11 and what I was saying at 8:15 and 8:30 and 8:45 and 9 o'clock. And, when you look back, it's like, wow, there's a lot of information that, because I didn't know. So all I could do is tell you what I did know. And then we filled in the pieces later as to what really happened. And you mentioned heart disease is another area where, for men, they studied all these things on men. And for women, they're still kind of grasping to figure out what does heart disease
Yes,
look like in women.
they don't even really know what a heart attack is for women or what the symptoms are the way they do for men. And the whole an aspirin a day helps prevent heart attacks. It's true for men, but they haven't been able to verify that it's true for women.
So
So
the statistics have proved that it's not necessarily effective for women.
not necessarily effective for women, and in fact may be harmful for women depending on who you are and what other conditions do you have. So,
Right.
you can't just go with what they've decided in a particular test group if you're not similar to people in that test group.
Right. Which just makes it so much harder for someone if they're trying to figure out a health issue for themselves, because you have all this information you're trying to learn, and you have to really look at what's new and what's old to see if they've improved their information. We do got to do. We're going to check traffic and weather here again. We'll come back and talk more with Julie Clark about statistics, not just medical stuff. We're also going to check the traffic and weather and news at the bottom of the hour, right here on WICC 600. Ann Carrick here on Connecticut Today, your guest host, and my guest, Julie Clark. We're talking about statistics and how they can sometimes be misleading. And one thing that people should pay attention to, with political polls or any kind of survey, is that if you write the questions in a certain way, then you get different answers, which again appear to support your theory. And it's really just because the questions were written in a biased way. And biased meaning in order to draw you to a particular conclusion as opposed to really just trying to unearth the details. Would you say that's true?
One of the examples I'd like to do in one of my stats classes is looking at the way the survey, the wording of a survey question, which was, do you feel generally happy as opposed to do you feel generally unhappy? And you get different responses depending on which way you ask that question.
Oh, so if you ask, are you happy, versus if you ask, are you unhappy? Interesting. Well, oh wait, I think your audio just cut out on me.
Sorry at all.
So wait, but so when you ask if they're happy, what kind of how does it what are the differences in the answers? Yeah.
You get more positive responses if the question is positive
Oh,
than you
okay.
get if the question is negative.
So would that be true, you think, for example, political polls, because clearly we're all, holding hands, singing kumbaya between all the parties at the moment. But so if they send out a survey that asks, do you dislike this candidate? Then you're going to have more people who are going to come back with a negative response toward that candidate.
But there are all kinds of problems with questions like that. One is who is doing the interviewing, because what the interviewer looks like or says or demeanor can affect responses. There's the Bradley effect. Now, for years the people want to respond in order to please the interviewer. So
Oh, that's the Bradley effect.
yes, that's the Bradley effect from an election that was, I believe, in California years ago, where a Bradley was running against someone who I can't remember, and I don't think I could pronounce his name even if I could remember what it was. And one of the candidates was black and the other was white, and respondents said they were going to vote for the black candidate because that seemed politically correct to them. But when they got in the voting booth where no one could see what they were doing, they did not vote that way.
Interesting.
There's that effect.
I think you bring up a good point though that when asked in a poll or a survey, people are going to be more likely to give the politically correct answer.
Right. They're going to
And
give the answer. I mean, if it's a face-to-face survey or even over the phone, it's a different thing if you're filling out a ballot,
in private.
where it's
Well, and
private.
that's why our elections and ballots are private. so that people can vote how they really want to. They're not swayed by
survey if it's not an anonymous response. You know, even if someone's not recording your name, if you have to look at a person and tell your response as opposed to anonymously writing it, you may give a different response. There's all kinds of issues, like they typically poll what they call likely voters. But being a likely voter is not the same as being a voter. And just because you give a response that says I intend to vote for candidate A doesn't mean you will actually go vote for candidate A. It doesn't even mean you'll go vote.
Right.
So there's that issue too. And of course we can't get a truly random sample of voters because the population of US citizens is too large. And so sampling methods have to try to adjust and make the sample representative. But that's next to impossible now, because if you knew what the population looked like, you wouldn't need to sample it.
Right. And look at how many people, I know with me, I've had polls call me to, and I choose not to answer, partly because of the work I do. I work in the news, and I'm like, I just don't want to get into the conversation. One, I talk about it all the time at work, so I really don't want to talk about it again on the phone with somebody. And two, I just don't even want to be recorded, even if it's supposed to be anonymous, with which way I'm thinking about voting or something, because my job is to be neutral and tell you the information and let you draw your own conclusion. And so I don't even want to go into that area if I can help it. You know, if you want to ask me about a specific issue, that's different, but you want to ask me about a candidate, I'm kind of like, then I feel like maybe I shouldn't say that. But
I won't give a response on a poll by phone. Actually, I don't know that there's any situation in which I would give a response, mostly because I'm a statistician and I just don't do it.
Right. All right.
But that, of course, skews the result.
Of course. Yeah. All right. We have to take another break for traffic and weather. We'll come back and talk more about the statistics. And thankfully, somebody answers those polls or we would have no answers at all. But all right. Right here, WICC 600 traffic and weather right now. And Carrick here, your guest host for the day. My guest, Julie Clark. We're talking about statistics and we were talking about polling, which, of course, right now with the campaign and election year, a lot of polling going on, and how the questions can be really misleading, as well as I had not heard about it under we called it the Bradley effect, where if it's a face-to-face question or even a phone interview, I would imagine that the people are more likely to say what they think they should say versus maybe what they really are thinking about, you know, from a voting standpoint. So and then, of course, we also were talking about how you and I and a lot of people just don't, we just choose not to answer, like we don't want to participate. So to me, that says those polls are pretty inaccurate, or are we assuming that, you know, that they're so random that maybe they are somehow a representation of the population?
No, the pollsters are deliberately trying to get responses from a certain segment of each part of the population. So they're trying to make their sample representative of the population. Of course, they don't always succeed.
True.
And they have no way of controlling whether the response that they get is truthful, you know, and if someone who says they're going to vote some way actually does vote that way. So there are all kinds of problems along that line. And we saw a good part of that in the last presidential election when the polls predicted one outcome and got another. But that's not the first time. Back in 1936, the prediction was that Alf Landon would win by 57% of the popular vote. And of course, you've never heard of President Landon.
I have not, for good reason.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt won that election and he won it handily. That poll was done by the Literary Digest, and they simply polled inadvertently Republicans instead of Democrats, and they suffered from a self-selection bias in that they sent out ballots for people to return to them. They sent them by mail in 1936 in the middle of a Great Depression to names that they got from vehicle registration lists and magazine subscriptions and so on and so forth.
Which automatically is only targeting the part of the population that is has some money to spend.
Right, exactly. And that was a huge flaw. And that year, Gallup, with a much, by the way, they had 2.4 million responses. So it wasn't a problem with not getting enough responses.
Okay. It's just that they sent it to the wrong people.
Right, right. And they allowed people to decide whether to send it back in.
Right.
So, you know, people for whom a stamp was expensive may not have responded. Gallup, that was his first year as a pollster, and he correctly predicted that election. And he did a great job until 1948, when he and everyone else in the country predicted that Dewey would beat President Truman. You've probably seen the newspaper.
That's the famous headlines, you know.
Famous headline where Dewey won. Of course, he didn't win. And by then, Gallup's method of selecting samples had caught up with him because he was also overestimating the Republican vote, not by nearly as much as the Literary Digest, but it did catch that year because it was a close margin that year.
Well, that's why you always hear about the silent majority in either direction, but you know, meaning that you've inadvertently somehow missed the majority of what people are going to do.
People who don't feel as strongly are less likely to give a response, but there can be a lot of those people out there, and they can be determined to vote one way and just not expressing that opinion,
sure,
at least not enough to get counted, and so that can sway an election.
Right. Another area that I see it in a lot is, especially for today's news, you know, when they're talking about racial inequality or, you know, and the likelihood of being shot by police, you know, the percentage likelihood, like people will say, well, the likelihood for someone who's black is 2.5 to 3 times the rate if you're white, of being shot by a police officer. And then someone else will say, oh, but way more white people are shot by police officers than black people are shot by police officers. Both are true statements,
right?
You know, because they're, and again, depending on what the person's trying, you know, because not the news people usually try to explain, you know, that it's percentage, you know, of people.
Right.
But if you're someone who's trying to prove that there's, you know, great injustice, then you just use the 2.5 times as likely. Or if you're somebody who for some reason doesn't think that there's an inequality there, you say, yeah, but there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of more white people are shot by police, and, you know, and then you have all the statistics over whether those police officers, what race were they, and all, you know, all this. And I think what happens is it gets so lost that most people just kind of throw their hands up and they're like, there's a problem, but I don't really know how bad it is. You know, unless you've studied the statistics yourself. And and let's face it, there's a lot of people, you start to talk about numbers and their eyes roll back in their head and the conversation's over. I mean, they would love to understand, but they feel like they can't even process what you're saying. And so they just kind of, you know, space out on you.
Unfortunately, yes. I am happy to say that I discovered that at the Duke Medical Center, there are tons and tons of women who do not have that reaction. Their reaction to numbers is, oh, cool.
Yay.
But you don't find that everywhere, unfortunately. So, yeah.
And I find it frustrating because I majored in math, statistics, and computer science. So when people give me information that's incomplete, you know, and I ask them for more information, it's very frustrating, especially in a medical situation where they give you some kind of, they quote you some statistic, and you can tell by the way they gave it to me that I'm like, well, you're missing half the information. And you ask them and the answer is, oh, we don't know that. You know, I'm like, what do you mean you don't know that?
So, I'm just parroting back what I heard, and I don't know where that number comes from, or, you know.
Yeah.
Count, but I don't know the proportion. Well, a count is not nearly as meaningful as a proportion.
Exactly. All right, we're going to take another break. It's time for traffic and weather here on WICC 600. We'll be back to talk more with Julie Clark. Ann Carrick here on Connecticut Today, your guest host, my guest, Julie Clark. We've been talking about statistics and how they are often, I'm going to say inaccurate, not because the numbers themselves are inaccurate, but because either the study was designed poorly or purposely to, you know, come out with a certain result. And you mentioned how people are less likely to be completely honest if it's a face-to-face question, that they'll go with the answer they think they should be giving as opposed to maybe what they're really thinking. You know, we've also talked a lot about medical, where statistics in medicine, and I can tell you from having talked to people with breast cancer, which of course, crazy number of people, women who have breast cancer, you know, and they talk about things like, well, surgery reduces your risk by half, and then radiation reduces your risk by half, and then taking certain, you know, medicine, not chemotherapy, like you think of where the person is super sick and loses all their hair, but like aromatase inhibitors or something, you know, that, you know, decreases your risk by half. And I'm like, so if you start at 50-50 and you have surgery, that takes you to 75-25. And then if you do radiation, you're at 87.5, you know, kind of thing. So when they talk about the final stage, which would be to take some medicine for like 5 years, I'm like, okay, we're down to like 6% of a possible benefit risk mitigation. And with a long list of really awful negative side effects and consequences that are pretty much a given. And so when I, you know, when you hear that, I'm like, it's not half, it's half of half of half, you know, it's this tiny percent, and it may still be worth it. But I wonder how many people actually hear that, you know, if you've been diagnosed with cancer, and you're having a conversation with an oncologist, you know, are you thinking about statistics? Or you're listening to them, and they're saying, well, it's going to, you know, reduce your risk by half. So maybe you should take it. You don't hear that it's really only 6%. It's not 50%. Is that something that you've seen in other areas? I mean, I imagine I'm picking on breast cancer because I've talked to people about that, whereas I'm sure it's true in other illnesses and in other parts of all sorts of life, you know.
It does make me think that we should consider treating cancer the way they treat it in dogs, for example. We've had 3 dogs with lymphoma, and they only treat with chemotherapy in an effort to put the cancer in remission, not to kill it. So chemotherapy isn't hard on dogs.
Because it's at a lower dose.
It's at a lower dose, and you don't try to kill the cancer the way we do in people. Of course, that means you're not going to extend the dog's life as long.
Potentially,
it
right?
It also means the dog has a more pleasant life because they don't get those horrid side effects that
right.
Humans. So, yeah, I mean, this happens a lot in terms of the risk, not knowing what's a good risk and not knowing what's a good risk for your particular situation, because, of course, all these data that tell you having surgery will cut your risk in half is based on samples from some what we hope is a representative population, but that doesn't mean it represents you very well.
Well, and again, I think if you press the people who are talking to you, the medical people, which of course statistics is not their background is medicine, you know, they do admit they don't know the answers. And they only can measure failure. They have no way to measure if some treatment has succeeded. They can only measure when it didn't work, you know?
Right.
And so for the patient, and it's, I'm picking on this one, but it's true in any medical situation, you know, you're sick, you don't feel good, whatever, or you're concerned, or you're undergoing some kind of treatment or something. You're not a statistician, you know, and you're sort of in a state of overwhelm, I would imagine, anyway. And now you're trying to absorb numbers and statistics. None of them are necessarily aimed at you. A side note, very disturbing in talking to people, is that, you know, again, picking on the breast cancer industry, they'll all hate me now. But, you know, you have all these people who are diagnosed and being treated and stuff, and no one is asking them any questions. We're talking about surveys that aren't done well. They're not even surveying the people. And I'm like, so how are you going to end up with better numbers and statistics and better data to give patients if you're not asking them any questions?
Part of the problem there is that it's not so hard to predict for the average. It's incredibly hard to predict for an individual.
Right.
Even if we have the data for a group of people, even a large number of women with breast cancer, that doesn't translate into being able to predict how you personally are going to respond or what your decision should be.
And that's what's really needed in for breast cancer and many, many other things is how do we predict your risk? Yes.
Right. What's your risk? And unfortunately, we're never going to be able to predict that very well.
Right. All right, Julie, we are time to go to traffic and weather again. I was going to say out of time, but almost. Traffic and weather right now, WICC 600. All right, Ann Carrick here, your guest host, and we've been talking to Julie Clark about statistics, and it's a complicated area and a lot of things that could be resolved. So the bottom line is, what do you want people to think?
I don't want them to be afraid of numbers. I want them to enjoy numbers, but use them wisely.
And do your research, I guess. Double check where those numbers coming from and how were they found.
Yes.
Okay. Julie, thank you so much for being here. Appreciate it. Not an easy topic. Next time we talk, maybe we'll pick one topic and get all the numbers from that and see if we can make some sense of it for people. Maybe that would be a good next time.
Okay.
My guest this half hour is Coach Connie from California talking about Cuba. Well, okay, sort of. We're really talking about socialism, what it is and what it's not, and is it something we really want? Before I get to that, since you are in California, just really quickly, how's the fire situation in your area? Because I know it's been all over the place. You're in a safe spot at the moment, I hope, you know.
Yeah, it's so funny. I feel like every time I talk to you, there's fires going on. Or maybe there's always fires going on.
There's always fires going on.
Yeah, and it's funny, too, because you've been hearing about, like, oh, my gosh, the fires are so bad. And then I saw something the other day that said, actually, we are not in the worst fire time ever. We've had worse fire times before. So there you go. Most of them are not contained. Very few of them are contained, and they're minimally contained. The very famous, I think it's called the Bucket or Buckles fire, which is that gender reveal fire.
Oh, right.
That one is only about 10% contained. So, and they've already had a death. So that's an interesting one that people are upset about.
I think a firefighter died, right? On the line fighting that fire. Yeah.
Yes. So we do have a few others. I have one that's only about 20 miles away from me, but it's in the mountains. So the chances of it kind of coming down are very rare. But there are some neighborhoods on the other side that are in jeopardy and have been evacuated. And that's like Arcadia, which is not that far from Pasadena, to give you like a point of reference.
All right.
So most of them are.
So are you you're like in an okay spot, but are you sort of in a wait and watch mode all the time or
no,
not even?
Not so much yet. Okay. I mean, it could happen. There was one very close to us, but it was put out very quickly. You know, just the problem is right now, everything is so dry and it's so hot that any little thing will spark a fire.
I think that's something people in other parts of the country aren't grasping also is how hot it is, you know, over 100 for days on
it's
end.
It's been better. We've gotten some better weather. And it's interesting too, because now you can maybe see a little bit out my window. It's a little bit of a blue sky. I can do this for just a second.
Right, I can see that. Yep.
You can see it. Listeners can't. But anyway, there's a little bit of blue sky, which is a treat because we've had sort of this apocalyptic. We haven't had those orange pictures that you've seen online, but we've had this weird kind of yellowy tint to the air. It's been like, smells like a cookout all the time.
Right.
Sounds nice, not so much. So anyway, the bottom line is it has affected us for a long time. So we're just starting to see blue skies again.
Well, that's good. Well, I'm good. I'm glad. I just felt like I had to at least check in on that since you're sitting in the fire zone, kind of. You know.
Yes.
All right. So back to socialism, our real topic for today.
Yeah.
I know I had talked to you in the past, you know, not on the air, just talked to you because you had a lot of information about that. So, you know, let's talk with, you know, socialism as an idea versus reality, because those are two different things. You know, the ideology of socialism sounds great, that everybody gets the same thing, the same treatment, the same opportunities, but making that happen is, I would say, impossible, but certainly really difficult.
Right. Well, first of all, you know, a lot of people see socialism in a lot of different ways. Coming from a Cuban background, to me, anything that even starts sounding like socialism gives me red flags. So I will admit right now, my bias in this area. Just get that.
Not a fan of socialism. Got it. Okay.
So yeah, I mean, here's the thing. Socialism as a concept, as you said, sounds great. You know, you've got this like sort of central governing body, but it's all very cooperative and they make grand decisions across the board of how the economics are going to work, how the money is going to be spent. It's a very high tax environment. And with not a lot of choices, you know, you have everything's kind of standardized. So on one sense, it seems like it's very equal. But in the other sense, I always remind people of a couple of things. When everything is so equal, there's really no impetus to move ahead, to have innovation. So as a result, you see a lot less innovation coming out of a lot of the socialist countries.
It's like having no competition in a certain industry than the one company that does. If only one company made cars, they just continue to make cars and they run, and but there's nothing new, no new designs or, you know,
right. And it doesn't mean that it never happens. Of course, you know, you'll see things, you know, get designed, but you just don't have that that impetus to just keep it going and raise the bar. You also have prices that are sort of artificially set because there is so little competition. So that's kind of the extreme form of socialism. Everybody kind of gets the same thing. But even in that form of socialism, there is one thing that people always forget. You have the proletariat or the ruled, and then the ruling class. And that exists with socialism, communism, all of these isms.
Somebody has to be in charge.
Exactly. And it always happens that the people in charge get a little bit more, or sometimes a lot more, than everybody else.
They get the better deal.
Exactly. So
they become the haves versus the have-nots.
So it's interesting because to me, the way I look at it is it sort of takes that lowest common denominator. So it brings people down to that denominator and maybe some people slightly up. But at the end result, everyone is more down in general than they were before it.
Except for maybe the ruling class.
Except the ruling class, exactly. So then what a lot of people are talking about now is this democratic socialism. And then they cite what's called the Nordic model. And the Nordic model is really what's happening in Scandinavia and the Northern European cities. And that does work in its own way for a few reasons. First of all, you have a very homogeneous group of people. They're hardworking. They have this real sense of country and duty, which has been there for centuries. They also come from a very similar background. It's an farming.
Oh, right. Agricultural. Yeah.
That's what I meant. Yeah. It's an agricultural perspective. And what happened was way back in the 30s, it was almost like unions were formed. And there was more of a collaborative discussion on, okay, how are we going to handle our economy moving forward? So you have a lot of this real belief that the government is working for you and you are giving your money for that to happen, for free childcare, for free healthcare, for free schooling, and all these other quote unquote free things. Well, in order to have that privilege, you're giving up 50% of your income. So basically half the year you work for the government to get these benefits, and half the year you work for yourself to get whatever.
Whatever you want, right.
Exactly.
The frills, so, yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, the biggest differences too are, first of all, what's happening now is their population is aging just like ours is. They're having a little more trouble trying to figure out how to fund this going forward.
Because now you have all these people who are older who are ready for all those free things that they worked for. And not as many people working and putting money into the kitty to pay for them.
Exactly.
Right.
And then the other thing that's happened to them is immigration, because this beacon of free stuff sounds great.
So everybody wants to go there.
Exactly. It only works because you have a populace that is hardworking and driven to make it work by being productive. If you get a bunch of people who come in and just kind of want to get the free stuff and live in a socialist state, they're not really producing and contributing. So they're starting to have a lot of issues with immigration as well. So now try to transfer that to our country.
Which is like a whole different situation anyway, but yes.
Exactly. So, you know, the one of the things that I find really interesting is that when you look at socialism per se, and when you start going from socialism sort of sliding into communism, communism is really closer to what some people in this country are talking about.
And when they're talking about democratic socialism, you think they're really kind of referring to communism?
It's a little more, because I'll give you a couple of examples. You know, freedom of choice for schools. That exists in the Nordic countries. That would not exist in our country. We've tried and tried and tried, even under a capitalistic society, and we haven't been able to get it under that. Can you imagine if one central governing body is running all of those things? You're never going to have a choice. It's going to be, that's your school, and that's it.
Where you go, and that's it.
Yeah. The other thing is, the Nordic countries don't have a minimum wage. The wage scales are really, what are you contributing and what is it worth? So in those countries, scientists and doctors actually make more money than, you know, kind of somebody who works at McDonald's, which is sort of what we have going on here. But the misnomer is, oh, we'll have everybody at this minimum wage, which is kind of high, even though the work produced is really a lower level of work. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it was never meant to be your life's career.
And it doesn't contribute as much to society.
Exactly.
All right. We're going to take a quick break here. Traffic and weather. We'll come back and talk more with Connie from California about socialism right here on WICC 600. And Carrick here, your guest host. My guest this half hour is Connie, Coach Connie from California. We're talking about socialism. You know, we were talking about it sort of in the abstract and a little bit with Nordic countries. Venezuela, though, is a country that people talk about all the time when they want an example of socialism gone wrong. You freely admitted you're not a fan of socialism, you know, but Venezuela, you know, I guess I'll let you speak to it, because I know you brought it up. Rich country, not doing so well anymore.
Yeah, Venezuela is a classic example of trying to impose a socialistic model on a country that's just not set up for it for so many reasons. So first of all, Venezuela was the most prosperous country in Latin America by far. And they had something unusual that a lot of Latin American countries didn't have, which is a middle class. If you look at most of these nations, there was a very high class and then there was a very lower level class. And there was really nothing in the middle. Doctors didn't make good wages in most of those countries. They had to work really, really hard to get up the ladder and sort of become wealthy, depending on how they could do that. But it wasn't a norm. Venezuela was one of the only countries where that was a norm. Professionals earned good, you know, salaries. So what happened is, when the price of oil went down, the country started to suffer. And instead of correcting with market corrections and more ingenuity and more products and all of that and diversifying the economy, they started sort of dabbling in working on the Bolivar, which is like their dollar, and, you know, trying to enhance the value of it, which never really helps. So they had started getting horrible inflation, and they started to take over some of the private companies. The minute you start doing that, what happens? The upper class leaves.
They take their money and leave also. They don't just leave. They take everything they can and leave. Yeah,
exactly. So what happened is, when Chavez came in, and under the banner of equality and being a, quote, charismatic leader, sounds just like Fidel. And by the way, he studied under Fidel. So Fidel Castro, I'm talking about.
Right.
For those of you who may not get that reference. Anyway, so he really believed that he was going to make everybody equal. Well, doing that by force, first of all, doesn't work.
People aren't equal. I mean, they're equal in value as people, but they, you know, not everybody brings the same skill set to the table.
Exactly. And so when you have an economy where you have this hyperinflation, you don't have a huge diversity of products, and you try to now all of a sudden put in more social programs and give away more money, quote unquote, you start to deplete the treasury, which is basically what happened there. So under this system where we're taking everything away from the people who have something, well, they're going to leave. So what are you left with? You're left with lower middle class and lower class individuals.
Well, you're left with all the people who don't have money.
They don't have an education.
And maybe don't have the skills. Right.
Right. So what's really sad about Venezuela is that the people who couldn't leave, who let's say were, you know, maybe middle class, upper middle class, they are now eating out of trash cans. the grocery shelves are empty. Where Venezuela won awards for education, now the children have to cross the border into Colombia to be educated. There is no water. Getting water into the high rises is not happening. So people, imagine in the middle of New York City, going to the East River and filling a bucket of water and bringing it home.
Right.
That's how we're living in Venezuela right now. And my printer is about to go off, so we're going to hear some interesting noises in a moment. Sorry about that.
That's fine. It's live. That's what happens. It's live.
That's how it goes. Here we are. So anyway, the bottom line is that it's become, should I mute myself and maybe?
No, that's fine.
Okay. So the bottom line is it's become this third world country that used to be just the beacon for all of Latin America.
Right.
So part of the issue too is that you do have this uneducated populace that cannot rise to the occasion either to create new things.
Right. They may be motivated and hard workers, but if you have they haven't been trained, they don't have the skills, there's only so many things they can do.
Right.
You know, you kind of go ahead.
Sorry.
I was going
to
say,
if you have the skills, there's nothing to motivate you because there's not even, you know, let's say you make some money, there's no food for you to buy.
Right. So why put your time into that?
Exactly. Yeah. So what people end up doing is they end up leaving the country because that's the most expedient thing to do.
So if they know anybody anywhere,
they will leave.
They go leave. Right.
Yeah. And I read somewhere that about 40% of the population of Venezuela is now gone.
Wow.
Which is astounding.
Yes.
What's left? The people who can't go.
The people who are, who are trapped, kind of trapped, right. Either financially, socioeconomic, family, whatever. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So wrapping this back into how would this work in this country? Well, first of all, the Nordic model, again, works because people work and everybody wants to contribute. And it's this sort of similarity, cultural way of viewing how the government works vis-a-vis the people.
This well, they have it. They have like a team spirit,
it's a team
kind
approach.
Of. Right. And yeah, I think exactly. With a smaller country, that's a little easier. I mean, we have a team spirit, but we need several teams because we have so many people and they're spread. You know, in other words, like we can't, one big team here is kind of unmanageable, you know?
Right. Exactly. And the problem is too, again, going back to that ruling class, we sort of already have a ruling class in this country and that's the government, right? So you have, you know, see senators and they limo around and they go first in the airlines and all those perks that one gets for being a leader. Well, now imagine if not only do you have those perks naturally because you have a leadership position, now you're running all these different industries because that's what ends up happening. Now all those profits, you have to decide where they're going to go, how they're going to be shelled out. Are you going to be favorite to the party that aligns with yours? How's that going to work?
Yeah.
You know, so it becomes much less cooperative and much more of an us and them situation.
Right. And so I'm glad you said that because part of what I was going to say before is you kind of glossed over where the government takes over somebody's business. You know, they've built up this great business that makes money and the government just steps in and takes it so they can have the profits because they need the money so that they can offer all these services that they claim to have available for people. And in our country, with our elected officials who are making good money while everybody else is like unemployed, pandemic, lockdown, reduced hours. Maybe it's time for our elected officials to have a little salary reduction. Or how about merit pay? If they can't get anything passed, then they don't get paid. Ooh.
Right.
All right, we have to take
I mean, I think it would be a great gesture to sort of take a month off pay, especially for the high-level positions.
Yeah. Maybe not the staffers, but the people who are making
exactly.
more than X number of dollars. We'll pick it. Oh, wait, traffic and weather right now. We'll come back. We'll finish this up. WICC 600, time for traffic and weather. Welcome back. Ann Carrick here, your guest host today and most of this week. You know, we said goodbye to Connie during the news there. She had one parting comment regarding socialism and democratic socialism versus the Nordic countries and their whole system. And that is that one thing they do have that we would not have here under democratic socialism is the flat tax and school choice, which historically have been more of a Republican platform item. So she just wanted to share that before she left. And speaking of political platforms, who better than Professor Ed Lynch from Hollins University in the political science department there to talk about the elections and the campaigns and what's going on. And, you know, we're getting a lot closer to Election Day, Ed. So, you know, what's your take so far on the whole campaign and upcoming election?
Are we getting closer? It doesn't seem like it's getting closer to me.
I swear we are. The calendar says
like
it.
One of those dreams where the corridor keeps getting longer and longer.
No.
Are running in it. Well, look, if the election were held today, I truly believe that Donald Trump would be the winner.
Really?
He's got the momentum on his side. It's not showing up in the polls yet, but some of those have a few days of lag time. Now, none of that is a prediction. That's why I prefaced it with if the election were being held today. Well, it's not being held today.
Right.
It's being held in November. And when you consider consider first of all, what things looked like 6 months ago, and then consider what things looked like 6 days ago before Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away.
That was going to be my next question, but go ahead.
I'm sure it was. And clearly this is an extremely volatile election cycle. A lot can happen between now and November the 3rd. So I think, predictions are probably a terrible idea, but I will say this, the Biden campaign has been at great pains to show former Vice President Biden answering questions, interacting with people, even if they're just reporters who are sitting inside hula hoops. They are clearly stung by the criticism by the Trump campaign that Biden is losing it mentally, and they are determined to demonstrate that that's simply not the case.
Well, I would think that will become apparent, yes or no, when you get to a debate where he's on his own to respond to whatever is said.
Yes, and that's going to be a big test, particularly the first one,
right?
Which is coming up, I guess, next week.
Yeah.
So we're getting there. We're right on top of it practically, and I think some of President Trump's recent statements indicate that he or the people running his campaign have realized that they might have been walking right into a trap. Biden has had some difficulties putting together a coherent sentence from time to time. And I think there was a very grave temptation there on the part of the Trump campaign to take him lightly, particularly as a debater. Well, you cannot take a 40-year veteran of the United States Senate lightly as a debater. I mean, as a senator, that's pretty much all he did. Governors have to run things, and mayors have to make decisions. But the senators, all they have to do is talk.
Right.
And all they have to do is make speeches and respond and debate. So Trump said a couple of days ago that he essentially acknowledged that Biden is probably a very good debater, and it's very important politically for both sides to kind of lower expectations. The expectations for Biden in recent weeks have got from the Trump campaign have gotten so low that as somebody said, all Biden has to do is wear a suit and not fall over, and he'll be registered as recognized as the winner of the debate. So that's a dynamic that the Trump campaign really has to change, and has to change quickly, or they're going to be a victim of their own characterization.
Yeah, I would not have thought anybody would think Biden would not do well at the debates because, again, all that experience. We're going to take a quick break here, traffic and weather. We'll come back and continue to talk with Professor Ed Lynch about the upcoming election and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, of course.
Of course.
And your guest host today, Ann Carrick, and my guest, Ed Lynch from Hollins University, professor of political science. We've been talking about the upcoming election and the upcoming debate between Biden and Trump, where I guess you kind of agree that, Biden should know how to debate. That's something he knows how to do. I'm just curious, what do you think about this whole Trojan horse, maybe conspiracy theory, that Biden is just a placeholder in hopes that he'll win so that Harris can actually become president? I mean, have you heard that? I mean, or do you think there's any validity to that? Or is it just people who like to make up stories?
Well, look, the plain fact of the matter is that if Biden is elected and inaugurated, he will be the oldest person ever to be inaugurated for president the first time. And the chances of course, of him serving two full terms are infinitesimal. Just from a sort of actuarial table point of view. I'm not talking about the politics, will he be elected?
Right, right.
But, you know, just looking at the actuarial tables, which means that probably from the very beginning, if there is indeed a Biden administration, from the very beginning, Kamala Harris is probably going to play a larger role than most vice presidents have. I would see her as kind of a Dick Cheney on the Democratic side, being given a lot of very specific responsibilities and probably being very, very visibly in the public eye. Now, you know, we mentioned Ginsburg's passing and the Supreme Court replacement debate that's coming up in the Senate briefly, but that's definitely a two-edged sword for Harris, because as a senator, she might very well be at the core and center of that debate and be on the floor and fighting it out with the Republicans, which will get her a lot of visibility. But on the other hand, she's not doing rallies in the swing states.
Right.
You can't be in Washington fighting against a Trump appointee and be in Iowa talking to the farmers both at the same time.
No.
There's only so much that a surrogate can do when people want the president or the vice president.
Right. And she can zoom in, but that's still not the same as being right there where you get to really meet her and feel like you know her better now. Mm-hmm. And I know Mitt Romney, I guess, recently made public that he was ready to vote on a nominee, which right pretty much means as soon as they have a nominee, it'll happen. I mean, after debate, it'll pass, though.
Well, Romney promised that he would allow a vote. He wouldn't try to block a vote on
right
the nominee. He did not promise to vote for the nominee.
No. I didn't mean to make it sound that way. Okay. I
think it's pretty clear that there is going to be a vote probably before the election on the replacement for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. That's becoming pretty clear because there are now 50 senators who are on board with that. The other sort of question mark was Lamar Alexander of Tennessee. He said he's okay with a vote before the election. That just leaves Murkowski of Alaska and Collins of Maine as the two Republicans. And that's 50, and that's all you need because you've got Vice President Mike Pence to break the tie, which you right do on either a procedural vote, shall we proceed, or on the confirmation. It would be a first that a Supreme Court justice is confirmed with a tie-breaking vote by the Vice President, but it could happen.
Right.
I think that if the President chooses one of the two women who are being talked about, both of them are relatively recent appointees to the appeals court. And what that means is that Lindsey Graham, who's the chair of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, a Republican from South Carolina, can say, we don't need confirmation hearings. We've already had them. We just had them for this.
Because we just confirmed them for the other appointment.
Nothing new is going to be added. It's just going to be a platform for YouTube videos. So let's move to a floor vote. I don't think that will happen, but I think he can certainly keep the hearings from going on for weeks and weeks.
He can make the case to shorten the length of the hearings.
That's right.
Yeah. Do you think that that putting a nominee forward is going to have any effect on how people view the two candidates for president, because it's going against exactly what they said in 2016, where they were like, no, we should wait till after the election?
Well, I think Republicans will make a couple of points. Number one, it's not exactly the same. 2016, we had a lame duck president. We knew that President Obama would not be president in 2017.
So we knew we'd have somebody new.
Exactly.
Right.
We don't know that this time.
Right.
And the polls are tightening. You know, it is really anybody's race at this point. That's one thing. And then the other thing is that the Republicans and Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, has said, look, the people voted for a Republican Senate back the last time they had a chance in 2018, and we made Supreme Court appointments a major issue in that campaign. So now that there's a Supreme Court appointment, we're going to do what we were elected to do.
Kind of, you've already made your choice on who you want to pick the next nominee,
right?
So let them pick.
Right.
Okay.
Now, my own opinion is that if Democrats were really being very smart about this, they would let this go through. because it would take a lot of the Republican never Trumpers, you know, the Republican establishment that never liked Trump to start with, haven't been happy with him, still don't like him. These were people who only voted for him back in 2016 because of the Supreme Court and the possibility of appointments.
So you might win them over.
You could, well, you if let's say it's Amy Coney Barrett, who's a good, solid conservative from the Republican point of view.
Wait, before you go down that path, we have to do traffic and weather. So okay. we'll do that, and then we'll come back and talk about her right here on WICC 600.
I told the vice president okay. I will do what it's
Ann Carrick here, your guest host this afternoon, my guest, Ed Lynch. We were talking about the elections and, of course, appointing someone to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So you were saying that you thought it would be wise for the Democrats to allow that to happen.
Yeah, I do. Part of the group that elected Trump back in 2016 were Republicans who really didn't like Trump very much. They were called the Never Trumpers. But they voted for him because of the Supreme Court appointment issue. Now, let's say that Trump makes an appointment and there's a confirmation. Basically, that will mean six conservative justices on the Supreme Court, and the Never Trumpers don't have to vote for Donald Trump anymore. They don't need him anymore.
They don't need him for that. So then they could vote for Biden if they want to.
Or stay home.
Well, okay.
Whereas the... letting that go through is going to energize the Democratic base in a way that Biden himself probably can't, quite frankly. So if I were advising the Democratic leadership, I would tell them to make a minor stink about this, but by all means, let it go through. You lose one Supreme Court justice, but you're liable to gain the presidency and two more in the next term if Clarence Thomas retires and Breyer retires. It's a roll of the dice, but I think it's a good one.
Yeah, I see your point, because then some people who might vote for Trump again just to have that Supreme Court nominee will not feel that obligation from an emotional standpoint. Yeah,
exactly.
Interesting.
Particularly those who don't like, you know, those Republicans who don't like Trump to start with. And there's a fair number of those.
Yes. Yes. The Never Trumpers is a very large, you know, vocal crowd for sure. Yeah. You know.
But most of them voted for Trump the last time, again, because of the Supreme Court, more than any other single issue. It was the Supreme Court that got the Never Trumpers
Interesting.
To come home back in 2016. So if that's taken off the table, then Trump wins in the short term by getting a Supreme Court appointment, but it could actually end up hurting him in the general election. Now, I don't know if the Democratic leadership is shrewd enough to think about that, but or to think that through. But like I said, if I were advising them, that's what I would tell them.
Interesting. But you really are taking a gamble then on who's going to retire and when are they going to retire to replace any others?
Yes. Yeah, you are.
Okay.
But that gamble is always there.
Sure. All right. We're going to take another break here for traffic and weather on WICC 600. Ann Carrick here, your guest host, my guest, Ed Lynch. We've been talking about the upcoming election and the Supreme Court nomination. So parting words, Ed, I'll give you the floor.
Okay. Well, a couple of things. Number one, I think we're going to see two very, very different styles of campaign from now until the end. I think Trump is going to hold as many large rallies as he can, at least what defines a large rally in the era of COVID, not as large as they were before, but he draws that energy and it energizes his base. Vice President Biden, I think, will play it safe, which he can afford to do because some of the polls have him ahead. And so I think we're going to see a very, very vivid contrast in style. I think we'll see that contrast in style during the debates. And I would just say that so long as the Supreme Court appointment and the whole controversy around that, so long as that is going, the major issue is not COVID-19. That benefits the president. Anything that directs the conversation away from COVID-19 benefits the president.
Okay. So the president does not want to be talking about COVID-19 from a strategy standpoint.
Exactly. He would much rather talk about the future of the Supreme Court, the economy, the wall, moving jobs back to America, anything but COVID.
Which is hard to do right now because COVID is just on everybody's mind because we're all still in this kind of weird holding pattern of a new normal, not normal something, you know?
Right, right. Except that we are now also talking about the Supreme Court.
Right.
Before it was just COVID.
Oh, that's true. COVID
and the Supreme Court, which again, from Trump's standpoint,